Good morning. Let's get started. I think we're in for a fascinating hour and 15 minutes. We're going to kind of understand and hear things that many of us, some of us are familiar with, but all of us have a lot to learn in terms of how this affects our lives, how we talk to our kids, how we talk to our grandkids, and so on and so forth. Dana Boyd is going to be our speaker and lead the discussion. Dana is an unusual person. She started out as a hardcore punk before she became a digital punk, going first from Pennsylvania, mid-Pennsylvania to Brown University to Media Lab to UC Berkeley, where she did her doctorate work, and has been engaged with MacArthur Foundation for the last couple of years doing a vast ethnography across the entire United States in terms of how do our kids today actually think about themselves and the world through the lenses of digital network technology. So with that, take it off.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. My goal today is actually to talk about some of the biggest phenomena that you've seen in terms of social network sites, MySpace, Facebook, etc. I want to start off by asking, how many of you have a MySpace or Facebook? Okay. How many of you have kids who have a MySpace or grandkids? Right. How many of you are here because you don't understand what it is that your kids are doing? Okay. Right. So, that's what I'm hoping to get across to you. My goal today is to give you some sense of why these sites have become so popular, what it is that young people are doing with them, and you know, why it matters. You know, for those of you who aren't going to stay for the session, the simple answer is that they're hanging out. They're doing all of the things that you and I have ever done when we were growing up, hanging out with our friends and goofing around. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. And so my goal today is sort of to flesh out what it is, what these sites look like, what their history are, and how do you actually make sense of the practices as they've changed over time. I'm going to start with some history. And some of this history sort of stems back a long time. These sites are a kind of a networked public. They're a public space where people come and they gather and they socialize and they create a public environment on the web. And networked publics have a long history in the internet. How many of you are familiar with Usenet? It's probably not that many. Okay, a couple. So Usenet, think of like a bulletin board or a message board, kind of like a pre-email type mailing list kind of structure. The idea is you could post based on a topic and people would respond to that topic. And they were organized structurally. This was back in 1979 that this was built. It was very much a geek-centered practice. A lot of it was, you know, you could go and if you were interested in the programming language Perl, you could find a community of people that were talking about programming language Perl and you could talk with them. And one of the things that was interesting about how this early form of networked publics emerged was that it happened at a time where the internet was relatively homogenous. There weren't that many people online in 1979, let alone in the 1980s, and by and large, they all kind of were interested in the same general things. And so the idea of norms emerged based on the idea that people had shared understandings of what the internet was supposed to be about. And so you'd have communities like rec.pets.cats, which would pop up, and people would sit there and have detailed discussions about cats. And I don't know how many cat lovers are in the room, but you can imagine what happens when a whole internet-based community of cats comes up and says all sorts of strange and funny things. Well, people learned what practices were acceptable based on posting and responding, but not everybody agreed on what was acceptable. There were a group of people who thought, who called themselves sort of troublemakers. They were part of another group of Usenet practitioners called alt.tasteless. And they had fun running around Usenet and invading other communities with often problematic approaches to their community. So, again, I don't know how many of you do have cats, but imagine a whole room of cat lovers being told how to cook, bake, skin, and otherwise mutilate their cats. It didn't go over very well, and it created a huge rupture within the community. And people were like, how do you stop these people? This is so offensive. We don't like this. And, you know, other people saying, well, this is the internet. The internet allows everything. And it's like, but I don't want to read about, you know, mutilated cats. And so this tension emerged about how do you actually protect and create spaces online? What are the ways in which you can actually bound communities? All of these interest-based communities were so free-flowing, and they didn't have clean boundaries. And this is where a whole set of mailing list practices came into being. And a lot of people left Usenet in that period and went to a bunch of sites called OneList and eGroups, which eventually became Yahoo Groups and big mailing lists as we know it. And these were mailing lists that supported the exact same things and the exact same communication patterns as Usenet, so people could come and they could talk about cats. but they were moderated. And they were very strictly moderated, who could be in the room, who could read them, and not unlike the mailing list that some of you know today. And a lot of that was trying to work through what is boundary making online. How do we deal with it? That history is really important because it sort of set in motion a whole slew of things that got clouded as we got a little bit obsessed with e-commerce. E-commerce sort of swept, you know, the discourse around the internet in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. People were supposed to be coming online to buy and shop, when in fact, by and large, they were coming online to communicate with friends and family around the world. We also saw a shift that happened during the e-commerce period, where what happened is that people switched why they were online, or the types of people that came online were different. Their practices were different. The big shift, particularly in public spaces online, was a shift from very interest-driven practices. In other words, I want to come online to talk to people about cats or, you know, people about motorcycles or my shared interests, to going online and communicating with people that you know. Right? And so most of us who use the internet today, we use it to talk to people that we know. We talk to colleagues, we talk to family, we talk to friends. This kind of friendship-driven switch became really, really critical because it really affected how public life on the internet was played out. As a teenager who grew up online myself, I spent most of my time talking to strangers about things that I was interested in. You know, I found out about Brown University because of people I met online. I found out, I started getting obsessed with gender theory because of things I found out online. I talked about the first Iraq War with people because I was online. It was very interest-driven. That is not the dominant paradigm today. So the dominant paradigm shifted as internet access became mainstream. It should be noted that Pew, in 2006, found that 93% of American teens 12 to 17 now have some form of internet access, although what they do can be very different. So in that sort of shift, you actually saw a shift for things. This is where we started to see blogging emerge. And for as much attention as given to news or political blogging, the dominant blogging paradigm is people talking to an audience of their closest and dearest friends. They have, on average, an audience of about 6 people. Right? Most blogs are not read by millions, and most teenagers who post to blogs never expect millions to read their blogs. And then along came a site called Friendster. Friendster was launched in 2002. It was launched as a dating site. It was launched as a competitor to another site called Match.com. And it was the first of the key social network sites. Now, if you listen to me, you hear that I'm keep saying social network sites instead of social networking sites, which is what you will hear in the mainstream press. And the reason is very intentional. Most people, while the dating sites and sites like Friendster were designed for people to meet new people, set in motion with this idea of going online to hang out with friends, people were not networking when they joined these sites. They were going there to goof around and socialize with the people that they know. And we saw that how they took off. So a social network site has sort of 3 key features to it that we want to make sense of. The first is some form of a profile. And these profiles, you know, they were really set up with dating in mind. So they ask questions like gender and age and, you know, questions about your sexuality, questions about your tastes and your interests. They're all set up for you to meet new people, and they're all set up to be a display for strangers. That is not necessarily how teenagers interact with them, and you will find that most teenage profiles give no indication of dating-like phenomenon. Her about me is some goofy picture for her friend. She's putting up, I can guarantee you, she is not 95. She is not from Christmas Island. Particularly because her friends are all about 17, and they all seem to be from New Jersey, right? This is a sort of good indicator. But she's not trying to lie. She's not trying to deceive her friends. She's trying to lie to the system so that nobody can search for her, right? And so there's this interesting question about what deception means online. When you're online to hang out with your friend, who cares what you fill out in a dumb form that somebody asks you to fill out? You don't care. You care about lying to the system. You care about being truthful to your friends. Your friends know you're 17. Your friends know that this is you, and that, you know, there's in-jokes that are about Zutterbutter and other such silliness, right? Next key component of a social network site is this articulation of friends. The term friends is extremely loaded, and I know a lot of people scratch their heads and are like, how can you have 9,000 friends? Don't worry, they don't. Right? The idea of a friend is not necessarily your closest and dearest. It's all of the people that you imagine yourself paying attention to and caring about within the context of the social network site. And so you see this variation in what people list as their friends. There are people that put 20 or 30 people there. That's their closest and dearest friends. They're treating the social network site as a very intimate space. There are people that usually have about 120, 150, up to about 300. You'll notice this is about the size of an average teenager's school, right, or their class. These are all the people that they run into at school, and there are good reasons for this, right? Imagine walking up to people and saying, "Are you my friend, yes or no?" Right? What are you going to say? "Yes, of course." Right? That's really awkward. That's a terrible, terrible thing to ask. And that is precisely what these sites require you to do. They require you to fill in and say, "Are you my friend, yes or no?" No in between. You can avoid, you can, you know, ignore the question. But you have to deal with this sort of binary. And so by and large, what you find is that when people fill out the friends, they say yes to anybody they've ever met or anybody that they have to be nice to even if they don't like. There are exceptions. Parents are often in that list, right? Because parents are allowed to say no to and deal with the consequences of it. But that kid at school that you're not entirely a big fan of, it's too socially complicated to say no to that person. Up that ante, you have people that are actually in the thousands. By and large, people that are in the thousands are engaged in practices of collecting. Interestingly, for as much concern about teenagers collecting, the biggest collectors are adults. They're called politicians. Politicians love to see how many friends they can get on MySpace or on Facebook. They think it's fun, right? So surprise, guess what? Teenagers do the same thing. Bands are also big collectors. The biggest collectors amongst teenagers tend to be on the younger end of teenage boys trying to collect as many girls as possible. Interestingly enough, spam artists have figured out that this is an effective way to spam teenage kids. So they make really hot profiles that say yes to teenage boys. But the teenage boys, by and large, that are collecting the large amounts of girls never expect to talk to them. They just want to look cool by having so many girls on their friends list. A friends list is also an imagined audience. It's who they imagine themselves communicating to. And so when they're thinking about what kinds of things to post, they make that decision very much based on what they have on this friends list. Third key component of a social network site is the sort of comments that you will see. This is another thing that makes people scratch their heads and go, why are kids writing this stuff in public? What you will find of most kids and their comment section on their profiles is that nothing of meaning is actually being said. Right? This is, "Yo, what's up? Not much. How you? Good. What you doing? Nothing. Back and forth and back and forth all day long." Okay. So what is actually going on here? What is actually going on is that they're doing the kinds of jockeying and sort of saying, you know, "Are you my friend? I want to make sure you're my friend. Do you still like me? Are you going to respond to me? Oh, good, you responded. Oh, cool. Okay, but are you still online? What's going on?" You know, and you go back and forth. And it's that dialogue sounds a lot like a phone conversation between an average teenager. And most of us did this for hours. I mean, how when we were 14 did we spend 6 hours a night on the phone? Was there a lot of real communication going on? Right? It's a lot of this, and a lot of it is trying to map out the turf of friendship. Right? This kind of social glue is how you actually build and figure out who are you actually relating to, who are you paying attention to, and it's building out those social ties so that when you need somebody, you ask for social support. This is not the place where, by and large, they're having those really intimate personal conversations. They're joking around and they're goofing around. They are sometimes engaged in things that will embarrass one another, and when fights break out between friends, it does take place on here because public embarrassment is deeply desired. But those are sort of the structures that you can think of as a social network site. So let's go back to Friendster for a moment, right? So Friendster was designed as a dating site. This was not how it was used at all. In fact, the three first early adopter populations were all in their 20s, and they were self-defined geeks, freaks, and queers, right? The geeks were by and large bloggers. The freaks were the attendees of the Burning Man Arts Festival that takes place in Nevada every fall, which is what JSB loves to remind me that I'm a part of. And the queers were primarily queer boys, primarily living in New York, who were actually using it as a dating site. They were the only population that was actually using it as a dating site. But these three early adopter populations basically came on site and started goofing around on the site. They started playing with it. They started actually creating buttons, and they would walk up to people and say, "Won't you be my friendster?" Right? And it became in jokes. It became part of urban culture, primarily in San Francisco and New York, although down to Los Angeles as well. And it was just sort of a fun place to goof around. One of the things that they started doing in the early days, because they weren't using it for dating, was they started creating fake profiles. Now, here were two very popular fake profiles. On the left is Burning Man. On the right is Ali G. And they competed. They competed to see which of these characters could get as many friends as possible. Friendster kind of flipped out as a company, and they said, no, you have to use this as a dating site. And they shut these characters down. There was also sort of goofy things. So they shut these characters down. There was all sorts of ways in which this became sort of a game of whack-a-mole. People started actually, the company started to attack the users and then going back and forth to the users. In return, the users responded with some nice commentary back to the company. One of the things they also did, I actually used to go and watch, they would protest the company at their office for the upset over the fact that they were doing this. Now, most of these were really, really cute. And one of my favorites was actually these love odes. Every day, Table Salt and Table Pepper would write love odes back and forth to one another about what meals they belonged in. And this created a whole culture of just like, can we surf around and see really silly things online? This is just beautiful. This is fun. Now, mind you, this is 2002, 2003 in San Francisco. Those who had jobs weren't doing very much at their jobs. And most of them didn't have jobs. People were spending lots of time on these sites. Right? What happened is that another site popped up around this time. And the reason why is that as Friendster was killing off its users who were not behaving, MySpace said, hey, we'll support it. And everybody went, how serious are you about this? One of the most notable populations on Friendster at that time were bands. Primarily indie rock bands in San Francisco. And the indie rock bands in San Francisco were being kicked off of Friendster for not being proper dating, although they volunteered, many of them volunteered to try to date as a group. That didn't really go over well. So when they actually started sort of jumping onto MySpace, they started having conversations and saying, hey, are you going to kick us off here too? And Tom Anderson, one of the founders of MySpace, who actually has a strong affinity for bands, actually reached out to some of these bands and said, hey, we'll support you. What do you want? And the bands were like, you for real? And they're like, yeah, what do you want? Well, we want to play our music on the site, and we want to have unique URLs so we can send people to them. MySpace went, sure, why not? Now, the interesting thing about bands is that bands have fans. And there's a symbiotic relationship between bands and fans, especially indie rock, small town bands. They desperately wanted to reach out and have a way to communicate with their fans. And that's what they were already trying to do on Friendster. So they started actually putting it up on the site, and it started working. Now, I don't know how many of you know much about indie rock as a sort of music phenomenon, but indie rock may be it may be 21 plus culture that's going to see the music live because the music tends to happen in bars. But it's not 21 plus who's buying the CDs, otherwise known as downloading them for free. The music is primarily listened to by younger people. So what happened is you started seeing this movement down. MySpace was originally 18 plus, but quickly you started to see the 16-year-olds and then the 14-year-olds. And each time this move went down, MySpace went, teenagers want to be here? Sure, why not? So they dropped it to 16, they dropped it to 14, and then there was a little bit of a moral panic. So we stopped really dropping the age very far. But teenagers started to come on here from two key paths, and they came onto MySpace as the first of the social network sites that they adopted, primarily in urban regions. And they came either because they were particularly interested in music themselves, or because they had older siblings or cousins in urban regions who were actively involved in music. This part also took off at a whole new level when MySpace actually began really supporting not just indie rock, but also hip-hop, two key music tastes amongst young people today. So this sort of spread into urban regions, and it spread by and large along different kinds of dynamics. And we'll come back to some of that in a moment. In the meantime, there was another site. Mind you, there were tons of sites like this popping up. There was another site that popped up at colleges, and this was Facebook. Facebook was originally Harvard only, and then as sort of people from other Ivy Leagues found out about it, they really wanted into it. And as other colleges find out to it, they wanted into it. And as the kids who wanted to get desperately into college and were looking ahead to get into college, they wanted to get into it, right? And it actually followed along these very interesting strata in terms of its growth around those who were sort of modeling themselves up to certain kinds of elite culture, right? And there's something very interesting psychologically about how this played out, right? Wanting what the Harvard kids had. And how that played out in terms of growth and how people played out in terms of their expectations. Sort of So one of the things, actually, I'm going to jump ahead for a second. One of the things that we saw in terms of how this played out and who actually started to use the site is that we saw a split as these two sites started to hit the teenage population, particularly in the 2005 to 2006 period. We saw a split around race, parental education, and otherwise other markers of class in the United States. MySpace became a working class tool for teenagers. Facebook became an upper class or middle or upwardly mobile class tool for high school teenagers. You saw this within schools, and you saw this across the country as to what was happening. It was a really interesting and sort of scratch our heads moment when we realized that what was going on in these social network sites was not simply about what, you know, who was actually adopting the sites or sort of like, you know, what the sites themselves were about, but about how friend networks were going. Now, one of the most important things to understand about how these sites sort of flow is that everything evolves around cluster effects. People go on these sites not because the site themselves is particularly interesting, but they go there because their friends are there. And they build out these clusters, right, of their friends and their larger cohort, and there are bridges to other cohorts. So people were going onto these sites and paying attention to what their friends are doing. So as more and more sites around the world have started popping up, they start to fill other niches. Right? In the United States, we are starting to see some splits away from MySpace and Facebook. Within the teen population, some of you may have seen your grandchildren or children start to pop up into Bebo, which is the one of the other ones that has popped up in the United States. There are other ones that are smaller and more niche that are sort of based on different demographics. So depending on what part of the country you're in, you'll see different things. But around the world, there's a wide variety of these sites, and they play out very, very differently. PsyWorld, for example, is extremely popular in Korea, and it's one of the few where young people and older people interact seamlessly in interesting ways on the site. QQ is the largest of the social network sites globally, and that's because it is in Chinese, it is in Mandarin, it is an evolution of IM in mainland China. And then you have a variety of different things that are sort of popping up. All right, so let's switch focus for a moment and talk about the purpose. What's going on with these sites? Who's using them? Or, you know, how are the teenagers using them and for what purpose? First important thing, they're using it to talk to the people they already know. They're using it to talk to their schoolmates, and they're basically taking all of those classmates home with them. They're creating always-on communities where they're part of their broader peer group, whether they are at school, whether they are at home, or whether they are out with their friends. And part of it has to do with sort of different kinds of structural reasons. It is also a site for self-expression. It is a way that, in which, not unlike, you know, the ways you can put up all sorts of crazy posters on the wall, you can put up crazy images all over MySpace and Facebook. You can sort of say something about yourself. It is a place for flirting, and I happen to really love this image because I found that this was a whole sort of practice that started emerging where kids who were not getting together in person but were dating because they were dating in school would make pictures where they would actually kiss and other such things even though they were in separate physical locations. I found this really interesting. Not the most common practice, but still fascinating nonetheless. More than anything, it is a place to hang out with their friends. It is a place to just goof around and be stupid. It is a place for gossiping. It is a place for socialization. It's a place for spreading jokes. It's a place for embarrassing one another. It's a place for doing all of the things that you might have done when you were hanging out in the mall, when you were hanging out in the park, when you were hanging out in the schoolyard before schools kicked kids out of the schoolyard immediately after schools. It was the things that people did whenever they gathered, you know, that whole sort of thing of like get on your bike, run around, be out with your friends, and be home by dark. This is what they're doing on these sites. If you're not on there, you don't exist. And that's not just sort of in this way of sort of peer pressure. That's it. If you're not on there, people can't send a message to you. Your friends can't send a message to you. So if you're not on there, you don't exist. You can't be communicated with. You can't even find out about when we're going to gather if we're going to communicate that way. You need to have that to get the updates of the photos to see what's going on. So a lot of people have often asked me, so why are they going there? Why don't they hang out in person? These are the kinds of answers that I get all the time. I'd much rather to. I don't have the option. Set into a little bit more of a disturbing kind of way. My mother doesn't let me out of the house, so all I do is sit on MySpace. And I started to track some of this down, and I found there was a sort of interesting dynamics that were playing out both in the U.S. and elsewhere. Some of the best imagery of this, or sort of best research of this, was marked out in the U.K. And don't worry about reading the fine text. The idea of this is four generations of one family in a town in the UK, and how far they were allowed to walk from their home by themselves at the age of 8. Right? Now, this is the great-grandfather. He had a lot of freedom, right? And then we have the grandfather. And we have, gets cut off, but we have the father. And guess what? The kid can't leave the yard. Now, this is not just in the UK. This is also happening in the US in all sorts of different ways. And I found that there are all sorts of different reasons, depending on communities, about why kids can't gather with their friends in physical space. There are fears, right? We are afraid that our kids are going to be abducted. We're afraid of pedophiles. We're afraid of anything that might grab them or hurt them, you know, if they leave the house, if they leave our view site as parents. Two, we have overstructured, particularly in middle and upper class environments, where they go from activity to activity to activity all day long, and they are extremely stressed out, often in the process of trying to get into college. These kids want to have some chance to talk to their friends, and they do it in interstitial spaces at any given time. As we move towards new suburbia environments where we don't have the places for them to go, there's nowhere to walk to, there's nowhere to bike to, and even if they could, they're not allowed to. We have all sorts of commercial environments now that are no longer allowing kids to hang out in those spaces, right? Mall of America bans teenagers. They're not the only mall who bans teenagers for hanging out by themselves. I love 7-Eleven has a policy of no more than 2 kids in the store at any one time. They're putting up buzz signs that are supposed to keep kids out of the parking lot. We have increased numbers of curfew laws, increased numbers of loitering laws, anything possible because we have this sort of dichotomous relationship to teenagers. We are afraid of them. We think that they are dangerous and scary and violent and gangs and all of the other things they possibly could do. And we are afraid for them. We think that if they go outside, they're going to hurt themselves. They're at great risk. We don't let them have any room to sort of be free and mess up. That dichotomous thing means that more and more kids are at home. Yes, they can socialize with each other at their friends' houses, often in structured playdates or other such things that require parents to drive them. This is not as much fun as goofing around with a whole group of people your age at the mall, right? And so given the choice where, okay, I can hang out with my friends, and it's great for 1 or 2 friends when they come over to the house, and you still see that happening everywhere in the United States, but if I want to hang out with my whole peer group, if I want to hang out with all the people that I know, I'm going to do it online because that's the one place where I'm allowed to go and hang out and goof around and be myself, and I don't have to worry about constant surveillance. Of course, a lot of that's changed. So, there's tremendous parallels to what's going on to these offline spaces. And yet, things are also slightly different. They're kind of weird as a result of it. And this is a lot of where you spend time scratching your head going, why did these things change this particular way? How technology affects practice is sort of key to understanding the dynamics involved. We mentioned sort of the complexity of saying, you know, are you my friend, yes or no, and all of the different things that way. And by and large, teenagers cope by making everybody their friends. Well, MySpace had an additional feature that really made things even messier. They had this feature that was called the top 8 and eventually called the top friends list. This is where you list your best and bestest friends, right? Now, think about that. That is about as socially dramatic as you can possibly imagine, right? And you hear these comments from kids being like, this is like high social drama, this is constant fights. And these sort of norms for who do you list in your top 8? The top position, if you have a significant other, is almost always reserved for said significant other. Otherwise, your best friend, but if you've got multiple best friends, you're in deep trouble, so you better come up with some strategy to cope with this. And if you really can't cope, siblings are really helpful. You can put siblings in because no friend will be upset if you put a sibling in there. And if siblings are complicated, bands. Bands are the saving grace. Put bands in your top friends and you're much safer than this. But still, teens by and large are trying to work out and trying to figure out how they list this. It still creates all sorts of social drama. And it makes something very clear from understanding of practices. We never formally articulate who our friends are. Yes, we have birthday parties and we choose who to include or who not to include. And then we're like, oh, Clay, I'm so sorry, I totally forgot. Don't tell him. Right? So we go through these funny moments where we try to balance that out. But this is persistent. This sticks around. Now, what this means is that some of the architectural bits of what we understand online are fundamentally different. So I want to walk through 5 of them, and I think they're really important to think about, especially for those who aren't familiar with life on these environments. The first is persistence. What you say sticks around. This is great if you want to have an asynchronous conversation. This is not so great if you want your mother to read what you wrote 10 days after you wrote it, right? Especially when you wrote it when you were really pissed off at her. This is not so great when your boss gets to read what you wrote when you were 15 and you are now 30. As somebody who grew up online, it's always really embarrassing when people find the old Usenet posts that I wrote. Persistence is sort of this troubling thing because it means that you actually have to deal with not just what are the consequences of the ephemeral action right now in my social life, but how will it be read or interpreted later in time? The next thing is searchability. My mother would have loved the ability to magically sort of scream search into the ether and figure out where I was, who I was with, and what I was doing, and she couldn't. And I am very, very thankful for this. Now, for most teens, they become extremely searchable. And they're searchable by people who hold power over them. They're searchable not by strangers who, by and large, don't care about them, but they're searchable by the people who know their names. They're searchable by their teachers. They're searchable by their parents. And that's where you get these deception moments of, like, I'm from Christmas Island. These are games to try to not be searchable, these attempts to work through and deal with the consequences of searchability. This is one of the weird things when you watch kids applying to college, where they're trying to figure out how not to be searchable in these environments. Next thing is replicability. You can copy and paste a conversation from one place to another. This takes hearsay to an entirely new level, right? So rather than just playing the game of he said, she said, you can copy what he said, she said, put it up on a blog, and all of a sudden that supposed private IM becomes extremely visible to a lot more people. The weird thing about replicability, though, is that you can't tell the difference between the original and the duplicate, and you can't tell if it was modified. Right, so a conversation, this mind you, is the core of where bullying comes in online. Right, a conversation that was copied from IM suddenly gets modified and put up on Facebook to embarrass somebody. But was it really what was said? Who knows? But it's still embarrassing, it's still taken out of context at every different time. Another key thing about this is invisible audiences. I'm able to stand here and watch you and try to gauge your reactions to me and adjust what it is that I'm saying. I have no idea who's behind that camera at the other end. And so how they're going to be reading this, how they're going to be hearing it when it gets sliced up, that's an invisible audience. And it's one that I have to think about and imagine, you know, how they might interpret it. And so they're going, oh no, when they actually do. There are certain people, certain professionals who are used to dealing with imagined audiences. People who are news anchors, people who write for a living. You imagine your audience, you imagine a handful of people, and you write for them. But what if every aspect of your just day-to-day social interactions were dealing with these kinds of invisible audiences? As a teenager, you're dealing with trying to imagine who might see this, not even just about who you list as your friends or who you close off to the privacy of your Facebook or MySpace, but who might read it as it gets copied and pasted to different places, how it will be taken at a different level, and how to deal with it. And nobody can accurately imagine that imagined audience. Even a seasoned journalist struggles with this issue. Imagine what you're like when you're 15 trying to learn this. Imagine what you're like when you're 15, and this is just a part of what everyday life looks like. And it means what you're seeing is a totally different way of growing up and interacting. Another key issue is scalability. What this means is that it's really great. The internet has all of these opportunities for, like, being able to reach millions and see millions, except that that's not necessarily what you get, right? What scales is extremely variable. What scales is often the things that are most embarrassing, the things you desperately didn't want to scale, right? It's like, look at a political campaign. What gets the most YouTube hits? It's never when somebody actually sits and writes something that they try to take seriously and they try to write a well-seasoned thing that bores everybody in the audience. People don't spread that. But boy, if somebody gets a clip of somebody, you know, doing something really, really dumb, that will spread. The same thing goes with teenagers. What scales on these sites is often very variable based on things that will embarrass, things that will humiliate, things that will, you know, create sort of different kinds of gossip or juice. But that means that you're constantly dealing with how far are these things reaching, what are the implications, how many people can see it, and people never know. I have a sense of the scale of this audience, I have no sense of the scale of that audience, and so the mediated context really changed those dynamics. These five properties also in turn change different kinds of things that we take for granted, things that we learn as part of our lives. The first has to do with context. One of the things that we do as sort of participants in everyday life is that we look around us and say, what is the context of this particular space and what is appropriate there, right? we know that the context of a bus is we're supposed to sit on the bus. Now, that doesn't mean we will listen, right? And the average teenager knows they're supposed to sit, will happily stand on the seats just to prove you wrong. But that doesn't mean you aren't aware of what the norms are. You know that the norm here is to sit in those chairs and to look like you're paying attention and to try desperately to stay awake, right? And yet what you will do last night or tonight might be very, very different, goofing around with the same people in an entirely different context. I welcome any and all of you to get up on your chairs and start dancing now. I personally would find this highly entertaining. But that's not what the norm here is. The norm here is about a certain kind of structure that we've all learned how to sit in a lecture. How do you learn these norms? How do you make sense of them? And how do you deal with it? And what happens when norms change depending on different audiences? One of the things that's really interesting is that young people who are faced with all sorts of lack of understanding of what the norms are in these spaces, they're trying to discern them, and they're trying to deal with different audiences at different times to try to make sense of it. This is something that we have a sense of historically. This is Stokely Carmichael, who was sort of a well-known political activist in the 1960s for civil rights in the United States. And one of the things that's sort of interesting is that he gave very different speeches to very different audiences depending on where he was in the country. And he used a very different set of vocabulary and vocalizations. He would go and speak before white politicos in D.C. using a very proper, posh, educated way of speaking. And then he would go and speak before Southern black congregations, speaking in a style that scared the living out of almost all of white society at the time, although it's been interesting to see that same style re-enter into politics. That style was seen as sort of problematic. In 1968, he was forced to go on television and radio. He was forced to make a decision. There was no neutral voice. There was no way to be heard by multiple audiences. He made a decision, and to this day, black power is viewed as anti-white. It had a lot to do with that history and how we understood it. For teenagers, they're also dealing with this different kinds of audiences, and they're trying to balance this out. And one of the places where this becomes pretty extreme has to do with people who are less normative to sort of powerful society in the United States. I got a phone call one day from a college admissions officer from an Ivy League institution. They had received an application from a poor black kid in an urban region who'd written a long essay about how his entire community was ridden with gangs and how he desperately wanted to get out of this gang-ridden community. They went to his MySpace, and they found that it was filled with gang signals. They assumed he was lying, and they didn't understand why he was lying, and so they were asking me what this MySpace thing was about, why he would lie, and then put the same stuff up on MySpace, even though they could find it. And I was like, he's not lying. Every day he has to go into school with those kids and those gangs, and he has to survive. This is inner city, south central Los Angeles. He is going to survive, and he's going to make nice with those gangs until he gets out. When he gets out, his MySpace will look very different, right? And you have to deal with these balances. So as we scale and as we think about how the context change, we have to deal with a very complicated notion of what it means when things are taken out of context. We also have to question how we get to learn what it means to make sense of context. You know, one of the things that kids know is they learn how to behave in public by their parents. That doesn't mean they'll listen and they'll happily ignore what you say, but they really do learn it. They really are paying attention and they really are mimicking what you guys do. How do you learn what's appropriate online? How do you learn what's appropriate in a highly mediated environment? Are we learning from Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan? I'm not sure that's the best of idea. Next up, how do we actually think about privacy? Right? We have this whole weird notion about privacy and about why are kids doing all of these things online? What does it mean? How are they exposing themselves? And yet, most kids are also say back to you that, you know, they don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as they have a different weird idea of privacy. And this quote is really interesting because what this quote is saying, where she's saying, you know, my mom always uses the excuse about the internet being public, but a girl needs her privacy. Public to her is not the same. They're having a conflict about what public means. Public online, for her, is a place to go where she can hang out with her friends and all of her peers. It doesn't include parents. One of the things I found really interesting when I interviewed teenagers about public and private is I asked them how private their home was. What I found really interesting is the vast majority of the kids in the United States don't see home as a private space. Why? Because their parents can walk into the room whenever they want to. Because they can't control who's over at the house. Because they've got little siblings who are trying to read their diaries. Because they have no sense of control. What you hear is in this weird sort of conglomeration of what constitutes public and private is that they're constantly coming back to a sense of control. And technology, while it will break control, will also give it back to them. And they become sort of desperate for an attempt to kind of have some sense of control. Anything that is about control is about privacy. Anything that is lack of control is about being public. And so it's not simply about what the technology theoretically affords, but what one senses of how visible or how much control they have over things. And the odd thing to see is that kids often feel as though they have more control on Facebook and MySpace than they do at home. That should sort of scratch your heads about basically adult notions of public and private are often very different than teen notions. There's also sort of interesting things because, you know, technology, by changing the scale of things, means that people want to be famous amongst 15 people. It may not be for 15 minutes, but they want to have an audience that cares deeply about them. But at the same time, as they're dealing with these audiences of public and private, there are people that they are desperately trying to avoid at all costs. And I want to sort of mention a couple of them. The first first group that they want to avoid is basically all people who have sort of power over them, parents, teachers, law enforcement, bosses, other such people. And of course, this is the joke, right, is that like if somebody brings your mom in. But the thing that's really interesting, you'll note the subtext here. Say no to child molesters. Which also is part of this thing is like one of the reasons why people didn't want adults on Facebook was because the assumption that at this point all adults, including somebody else's mom, might be a potential child molester. It's a very interesting notion about what the dangers of adults are and the lack of the ability to engage with people of older things. The other group that people try to avoid is those who have a predatory intention. Interestingly enough, most predators online are not sexual predators. Most are spammers, scammers, marketers, and other people that want your money. And so most of the time is spent trying to avoid that group. I will happily answer questions about child molesters and all the predator problems in the Q&A if you want to go there, but I'm going to ignore it for this. There are different ways for coping with these things. The first is actually trying to create walls. This is trying to build walls in a digital environment, trying to make yourself not searchable, trying to make it very difficult for people to see you, and try to deal with those different balances. The reason that I put up this picture of a wall is I think that it's really funny to think about what it means to build walls in a world of airplanes. Right? Walls were much more effective when you were just dealing with physical forces that were walking across borders. Much more difficult when you have planes. And so you have this interesting game as people try to build walls in these sites of trying to go back and forth between can you build a wall faster than somebody can build technology to climb it. Another thing, of course, is attempting to deceive and trying to create different information, which we talked about before. Another one which is sort of interesting is this way in which you say, try to demand social norms, to say this is what this will be about. And this is like, but it's my space. But it's public, but it's my space. And this sounds a lot like, it's my bedroom. But it's my house, but it's my bedroom. That was certainly a fight when I was growing up. And so this way in trying to say, this is the norm, this is what you should respect, this is often problematic. The interesting thing is that adults tend to do a third technique, which is they try to bury their heads in the sand, and they say, if you don't see me, I don't see you, so we will be fine this way. Teenagers are less inclined to do this, but adults are doing it pretty commonly. As we think about what this means as we go forward, what you're starting to see is that while many of the practices and the goals are actually absolutely the same as the things you and I grew up with, the ways in which the technology is interfacing with this changes things and sort of scales it out of control and makes it really kind of odd. But it changes the way that we will interact in the future. Kids are learning how to deal with public life and to deal with social life as part of coming of age. That is what we all do. What does it mean with these technologies as the things that are taken for granted? And frankly, what we have moving forward, now that we've got mobile phones in the hands of most teenagers, is we will be changing the rules of location and space as well, whereas this sort of presentation doesn't cope on that. This is going to change what it means in terms of how people interact. It doesn't mean that they interact less. They are just as social. They are just as flirty. It's that they are engaging in convergent practices. Flirtation may start based on like sort of a cute eye that you meet somebody, you know, at school. The conversation may actually go with nice messages that you leave for somebody on MySpace or Facebook. And then, you know, when that gets hot and heavy and you're actually having conversations back and forth, go to IM for a more serious conversation. And then maybe the mobile phone. Right? So flirtation is no longer just in school. It actually moves through different technologies as part of everyday practice. It also means that all sorts of, you know, social gatherings and ways in which information flows change. Learning has changed. Kids are spreading information about homework on here just as much as they are spreading information about their teachers and what they think about their teachers, right? So good and bad. They're scaling that information. They're doing tons of collaboration work. Almost all the kids that I was talking to about that were in their senior years of college were all finding out about colleges through Facebook. I found it very interesting, much to most university chagrin. Kids would actually go and say, the university gives kids a list of people they should talk to find out about how great the university is. And kids would be like, haha, I don't want to listen to that list. And they will go onto Facebook and find the people they want to talk to and find out what the university is really like from a much more local perspective. They are doing unbelievable information gathering through these sites. They are engaged in all sorts of news information. This is how they're finding out about things. Things spread. When Virginia Tech happened, I was actually in the field with kids, and the vast majority of them had heard about it from MySpace or Facebook, because people just started posting, oh my gosh, did you hear? Oh my gosh, did you hear? And enough of that it spread like wildfire, even when kids were in school. Mind you, think about the timing of when Virginia Tech happened. Kids were in school, but they were checking their pages between classes. And so they were finding out about things, and then it would come back into the classroom. And I remember talking to one kid who forced their teacher to actually respond in the social studies class, being like, look, I love that we're studying this, but this thing is happening. Can we talk about it? That's sort of an interesting way of changing the ways in which information is flowing. As these kids get older, it's going to change what their assumptions are about work. Those of you in professional spheres have already seen this. As you have younger employees who think it's very, very strange that you want to call them instead of sending an IM. IM is the obvious thing, right? Or email. Why are you calling? So you have sorts of different kinds of changes that you're seeing in the workforce about how information is supposed to flow. What is the most efficient means of communication? How do you make communication choice based on what is most effective or what is more useful, right? You also see that this is changing. I'm sure some of you have seen this at home, where it's easier to email your kids than to walk up to their bedroom. You'll get their attention much faster, or not even email at this point. At this point, it's IM or calling them, leaving a text message, etc. Different technologies are used in different ways for communication across generations. And part of it is that when you have an unbelievable choice of what media you can use for communication and information, you start to optimize things based on very specific things. You find out what is most effective and best for communicating with which people, and what is most effective and best for communicating in which contexts. You know, and so, I have teams also map out a list of who they talk to using which communication channel. It's not that MySpace and Facebook are everything, but they're really good dumping grounds for all photos. They're really good places to leave and sort of say nice things to people that you only sort of know. But more intimate conversations will move to places like text messaging or IM, depending on the group. Now, of course, text messaging, for those who are parents, as soon as all of the, we start to see this pure drop in, the cost of sending text messages, as you hit all-you-can-eat plans, and those of you who have kids have hit all-you-can-eat plans, you will watch text messaging become the communication channel, hands down, bar none. That's not quite there across the United States because of the economic models, but it's getting there pretty fast. But this is going to change things as we know it. Things are moving in all sorts of different directions. And it's not something to be afraid of, because the underlying practices are the same, but they're getting morphed. And part of it is understanding the technology to understand what those morphings are and understand how to relate to one another. At this point, I'm going to cut off so that I can leave plenty of room for questions and sort of go in the directions that's useful to you. So. Right. So YouTube in some ways has all of the same structures as a social network site, in that it actually allows the friends, it allows all of this to go on, but it's actually not used in the same way. YouTube is by and large used as, there's a couple of different practices. One is pure, you know, consumption, which is like, if I missed the TV show last night and someone managed to put it up before Google managed to take it down, I will go there and I will watch the show last night, or I will watch 6-minute clips of it cut across lots of different places. I will go there to watch sort of funny videos that are spreading across the web. These are, you know, like joke videos. Some are sort of not the most positive videos, but, you know, sorts of things like that. And this is consuming of things that look a lot like television practices taken online. There's also a whole set of amateur content creation by teenagers that is taking place. And more of this is actually starting to happen. It's exciting to see. Some of it started for classrooms, right, where it's just like you have to make the video of reenacting the revolution, you know, July 4th, 1776, reenact it and put it on for class. In wealthier communities, you're seeing that sort of forced curricular, but you're also seeing people just do it once they have a video camera, whether it's the one they borrowed from school or whether it's the one that they have, or it's now their phones. They're making 30-second, 60-second videos of themselves goofing around, doing whatever they want. A lot of it is in jokes. A lot of it, like teenage blogs, is not that interesting to most people. But it is interesting, the closest group of friends. You have underneath YouTube, you have a whole set of communication, comment section and response options, all sorts of different things. This is being used by a much more niche population. It is being used, but it's not necessarily mainstream. The vast majority of teens are not actually commenting on anything but their friends' videos. There are groups of teens who are engaged in much more complex practices. And I should note that I'm talking about pretty mainstream practices, but there's some amazing groups of kids who are making really complex videos that are taking content from all over the web and slicing it together and putting together fan videos or remix videos that are just unbelievable. There's a whole culture of something called machinima, which is sort of reenacting acts in a virtual environment, something, you know, like a gaming engine based in virtual environment, and then making videos out of that. A lot of those get pummeled back to YouTube. But the vast majority of it is really just sort of goofing around with friends and being silly. YouTube sort of brings out a lot of questions sort of broadly about attention economies, because most videos on YouTube do not get that many views, much to the chagrin of those who are trying to reach millions. And so there's sort of this really interesting, complex nature. It's like there are kids who will sit there and surf, but what they're surfing is often, you know, things that they'll find funny. They're surfing music videos. They're surfing things based on celebrities or based on their friends. They're not necessarily surfing political ads. So you get this sort of thing, but it is definitely there, but it's much more part of a media consumption environment than it is sort of the social network site structure. Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the people who have risen through this environment, because there are emerging sort of stars or people with huge celebrity in this environment. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what sort of things they're doing and how they're doing it and what it is, as you see it, that is creating the additional attraction?
Right. The celebrity. Every new media brings out new celebrities in it. There are certainly celebrities. Most of the celebrities have been amongst the 20 and 30-something crowd, have not been amongst the teenagers. You have people like Tila Tequila, who desperately wants to be the next porn queen, and she tried to basically gather as much attention as possible through MySpace. You certainly have musicians who have used MySpace to do that kind of attention management. The teenagers are sort of interesting. I've seen a handful of teenagers who've done some really interesting things on this space. A lot of it is music-driven. Now, mind you, almost all of the true celebrity structures is MySpace, not Facebook. So there's kids who are putting their bands up, and they're actually managing to get, you know, backup gigs, or they're getting, you know, being able to do sort of an opening act for a local band because of something they put up online. And so they're managing to use it to get some sort of status within the local music communities. That's been pretty effective. There was one girl who sort of notorious, who managed to actually get a clothing designer contract based on all of the clothing designs that she was putting up on MySpace and doing so regularly. There's another teen who I watched who makes handbags and was able to actually get an internship based on that. You're seeing certain things that they're not necessarily rising to full celebrity, but they're getting access to internships. They're getting access to traditionally adult-driven media creation types of points of view. But most of the celebrity, the celebrity just for celebrity's sake, that is much older in terms of populations.
Yeah. Do you see these three-dimensional virtual worlds like Second Life, et cetera, just as extensions of this 2D, two-dimensional form of social networking? Or are they attracting the same audiences, or are they fundamentally something different?
So, no. People want Second Life to be the Web 3.0, and I don't believe it's going to happen that way. Immersive environments require a lot more attention than these sites do. I should note that MySpace profiles, most teenagers created profiles for their friends. So their friends didn't necessarily want to get on right away. Their friend created one for them. And so I don't know how many of you, they're also creating profiles for their parents, which is always really entertaining. So they'll create a profile for somebody that, you can check your profile, every 5 minutes, but your friends don't have to. Your friends can engage at totally different levels. And that's A-OK, right? And so you can be part of this communication environment even if you can't check things for the next 3 days and even if you can't engage in synchronous behaviors. Most of the immersive environments rely heavily on synchronicity, which means we both need to be online at the same time. And this is effective, mind you. Massively multiplayer online role-playing games are, relatively huge in this space, and teenagers are using them. But it's, again, the same sort of environment where if you're at level 70 on a game and your friends are at level, 25, you can't really play with them in a comfortable way. Now, immersive environments like Second Life don't require that kind of leveling-based structure, but you still see some awkwardness about what it means to be on at the same time, to have the same basic levels of skills. It's not just a baseline communication thing. It requires much more depth. A lot of it is about trying to be really interest-driven and build and act and whatnot. And these are really popular for niche populations, but they're not hitting the mainstream like this. What the mainstream really wants to do and where it's going for teens is mobile. And the question is, what is going to happen in the mobile space? Right now, we have huge barriers to innovation in mobile. The ideas of what could be done with mobile far extend beyond what the carriers will ever allow right now. And we get extreme cluster effects that happen. And this is one of the things that makes things difficult. I mentioned about Facebook and MySpace. If you are on Facebook and your friends are on MySpace, you cannot communicate with them across the system, right? If you're on T-Mobile and your friends are on Sprint or somebody's on Verizon and you have different phones, you can't do the same things. You can text and you can call, and maybe if you're lucky, you can send a photo to one another. Maybe, right? And that's about it. The result of which is you don't see innovation happening in mobile, but people don't want to become more immersive. I mean, the kids don't want to be obsessively behind the screen. They want to be connected always on to their friends. And if they can take their friends and put their friends in a pocket and go wherever, they're game. And that's whereas I don't see the immersive environments sort of as that next leap. I see any attempt to take it with them and move around the house as a much more viable thing, even if they can't leave the house. You want?
I'm wondering if there have been any psychological studies done with people who've grown up with this ability to be online with so many friends in terms of social and emotional EQ and emotional learning. Because I know myself, even with email, sometimes the context is not really what you're trying to say. People pick it up differently. So how are they learning intimacy?
So the question is, how are they learning intimacy and relationships? What are the sort of psychological effects of this? One of the things you see with teen engagement on these sites is that they've learned new techniques for talking to their friends. They're doing it at the same time that they're learning techniques for doing identity and for communication. Yes, they're messing up. Yes, they're dealing with the consequences of it. But that's also part of teen life in general. I mean, especially when you get some of the dramas that play out that are part of figuring out the social categories from middle school into high school, the same thing about who's popular, who's not, that's playing out and it's filled with miscommunication, but it's filled with miscommunication in school and online. The thing that's really interesting, I've seen one study that sort of raises questions about how effective kids can be at reading certain kinds of facial expressions, and there's a huge question about that. Kids have figured they have totally different patterns for non-verbal communication online, not just the like smiley faces and goofiness, but also the ways in which they do temporal patterning, which is actually really critical to the communication. How long do you wait? What are the games that you're doing as you're sort of pausing and playing as for synchronous communication? There are a lot of questions. But again, one of the things I sort of push back on is that I'm not thrilled that kids are on these sites all the time because I would much rather them be allowed out of the house, but that's not their problem. That's a much larger societal problem about why they're not being allowed out of the house. And I think that if we can get environments where they're allowed to go out and roam free much more will get much more of the integrated. I do think that their ability to do the always-on becomes really, really powerful. One of the things that we also know is that later into the evening, for whatever reasons, kids are much more willing to actually share some emotions. They do a lot more emotion work with their friends late at night, and that's almost always through mediated communication channels. And this is all, you know, both with significant others and with same-sex peers. They do a lot of that working through in ways that they may not have been able to do prior to mediated environments because they wouldn't be able to get together late at night. So there's sort of, it's totally changing the topology, and I think there are great opportunities for more research to be done in particularly the psychological range, but I don't think that there's enough known right now. There's just more question marks than there are answers at this point. Okay, I need, can you help me with people? There's the hands everywhere. Are you, Kitty?
you put up, so we have these two mega sites, Facebook and MySpace, and then you put up this whole range of niche sites. So there's some tension between a whole age cohort in one place and go to a niche. How do you see that playing out?
Right. Well, so the sites that I put up are primarily different sites around the globe as opposed to niche. Like, you can't really call Cyworld or QQ really niche at this point since they're larger than MySpace. There are niche sites out there. The niche sites, by and large, fall under two different structures. One is identity-driven. So you have niche sites that are like Black Planet for the African-American black community, primarily in the United States, although theoretically anywhere. Mijante, which is Latino and Hispanic communities. You have Asian Avenue, which is Asian. Those are sort of community connect properties, are sort of a classic identity-driven niche population. You certainly have that for queer kids. There's all sorts of interesting online queer spaces, again, identity-driven. Then you have the flip side, which is much more interest-driven. So, and there, mind you, I'm giving you general friendship-driven trends, but there are kids that are super interested in things, and they're super interested in talking to people online about really interesting things. What really scares me is how many of these kids who would be really interest-driven are discouraged from doing so for the possibility of interacting with a stranger online. So, you know, I talked to this one girl, and she was obsessed with Harry Potter. She loved it. And so she read every detail and discussion and description, and she knew all the sites to go to. And I was like, well, you know, do you contribute? Do you post? And she's like, no. They might get my home address, and then they'd come and rape me. I'm like, oh, no. Right? So you have kids who are deathly terrified of participating because of the culture of fear that we have done a really good job of propagating as a society. But there are still kids who will overcome that and interact because it's really advantageous. As one of those kids who grew up online, I can't tell you how powerful it is to realize that the world exists beyond your local community. So you're seeing these kids who will join these niche communities and really get into something. And, you know, I think that we'll probably do some more of that tomorrow and some of that niche-driven learning in particular. But, you know, you have one of the things Mimi, too, who I work with, she looks a lot at, you know, kids who come together for, and they will subtitle anime music or anime videos, and they will collaborate with one another. They create a whole community of people that know Japanese and English and sit there and go through and subtitle all of it, and they talk about different techniques for subtitling, and they're learning how to subtitle. They have a community, and they are very powerful, and they're very connected. And, you know, often they get to meet for the first time when they go to college. That's sort of the interesting thing. So they're not meeting when they're in high school. They're talking online for years, and they're meeting later. And I think I really like the interest-driven communities. I think they're really powerful, and they allow us a lot of room. I think that we have systematically discouraged them, and it's only the most marginalized and socially ostracized that are realize that they don't have enough flexibility in their everyday life, and they find that this just far outweighs it. I would like to see us doing more to encourage interest-driven communities, but that means stopping being so afraid of the internet.
My son is 18, and he's a friend of Obama. So I'm actually kind of curious what happens to these teenagers as they move into their 20s and get political. I don't know if you reflected on this, but it's been pretty fascinating to watch a subgroup of friends of Obama react to his FISA.
Oh, yes. Sure. So Obama, mind you, this is sort of an unbelievable case of young people engagement with a political participation, and a lot of it is happening online, and it is amazing to watch. And it was amazing when I was doing my field work just how many people were aware of Obama and at least read some of it or seen some of it. There, you know, the people who are participating in the Friends of Obama on the actual Obama website tend to be much more of the more active kids. They're not they already are politically motivated. Mind you, the number one sort of correlation with politically motivated kids is politically motivated parents. So I strongly encourage all of you to go and talk about politics. Even if you're talking with your partner about politics, talk about it at home. Kids will pick it up. So when kids engage online, they're starting to pay attention. And the thing that's been interesting about the FISA move, so what happened was Obama sort of said that he would support a particular, he would support FISA, supposedly with immunity protections, although questions arise. Many of his constituents are very unpleased with this. And so they create, there's a whole group structure on the Obama website where you can actually participate in groups. What happened was that particularly young people decided that the way that they would voice their opinion and their frustration is they would make a group that basically, I forget the actual title of it, but it's basically like, you know, don't support FISA, we aren't with you with this, you have to stop, something along these lines, and they signed up. And what they started to do was they started to sign up more and more, and even if they weren't themselves participating in the group, they knew that by getting that group's number high, they would reach the press. And it was very, very effective. Now, what they did is actually has a historical precedent. And most of these kids were on Facebook who did this. So what they remember was when a feature called the news feed launched in Facebook. And they were able to create a particular group in Facebook that said, you know, basically, Facebook, stop the news feed. We don't like it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they managed to get 700,000 people on Facebook to sign up for this group, mind you, using the news feed to do so. And they forced the company into actually changing the news feed. They didn't delete the news feed, but they actually made them change the privacy settings of the news feed. That motivated some of the more politically minded, sort of civic group-minded kids in ways that were sort of interesting. They were like, wait a minute, we can actually make change this way? This is kind of effective. And so you're seeing some of these kids start to use the same techniques that they learned to put pressure on Facebook as a company to start to put pressure in these other environments. And that FISA move is exactly aligned with it. And so some of the things that you hear the kids saying on the site follows the same thing, which is like, if we get enough people to sign up for this, he'll have to respond, the news will have to respond, things will have to be done. And so they basically run around and said, you don't have to actually participate, just sign up, and that's good enough. And so, again, this is where you have this many-leveled opportunity, where if you just need a small percentage of kids who are super gung-ho and motivated to run around and convince all your friends, and inevitably your son is probably one of those, to run around and convince everybody. And then if they can get enough people to also be sort of coming aligned just to say, yes, I'm here, the hope is that that can be effective. There's a lot of questions about what that means long-term, and I think that, you know, for me, I'm watching the Obama campaign, watching to see what will happen, and I think we will see a lot of interesting lessons, and we'll see a lot of interesting use cases that the kids have actually learned how to do through their use in social network sites.
One more question. This question relates to the safety of our teenagers and our youth. You know, as a firm believer in, you know, the freedom of expression, and as we watch in the House, yes, they do need to not be fearful of MySpace and Facebook and go ahead and have a field day, but there's a fine line, and I don't think I'd like to know if you have any recommendations on the solution to this. Perfect example is, you know, my kids are on Facebook. I have and they lie, you know, their age, they lie, they start in sixth grade.
It's almost
when they're in high school. But my son, teacher, was arrested this year, and was in sixth grade, for soliciting a 15-year-old boy online. So, you know, while the kids don't have any fear of any of that, because I don't want them to see my daughters or, you know, the perverts and stuff, there has to be some way of, like, making them understand, because kids are fearless and they don't get it. That just does happen. And we can have them in our own backyard.
You know? So, yeah, I mean, okay, don't get me wrong. Sexual solicitation does happen. It happens far more offline than it happens online. And this is often really a shock to people. The sexual solicitation that happens online is actually primarily that which falls under statutory rape. And interestingly enough, it is almost always teenage girls seeking out older guys, often initially to get alcohol. sort of a really scary picture when you start to look at it. So we actually started to collect all of the data on what's going on in terms of sexual solicitation that's taking place on MySpace and Facebook. This is work done by the CCRC up at the University of New Hampshire and work done by iKids. I can give you tons of papers on this material. What we find pretty conclusively is that it is almost always 13 through about 16, 17 engaging in sexual acts where they know that these guys are between 22, 23 up until about 30, right? And they know, they meet for sex, and they meet repetitively. This is not the picture that you get from scary TV shows, right? The 40-year-olds who are sort of soliciting sex online, by and large, are finding cops more often than they're finding kids who respond to them. That's exactly how the teachers get caught, because kids don't respond to that. That's gross. And that's where you have a lot of education to be happening. Most kids, you can do a lot of education about, like, when somebody asks you to show them pictures of you naked, no, don't do that. Bad idea. The number one risk that is really realistic that we have to pay attention to with our kids has to do with bullying. It is bullying that takes place offline, it is bullying that takes place online, and it's become convergent like everything else. That is a genuine risk. Kids are harming one another very regularly, and they're using every tool available to harm one another. Interestingly, this has a lot to do with a culture of age segregation, where when kids only know people that are of their same age, they don't go through ritualized hazing. So it's interesting to see in communities where you see a diversity of ages interacting with one another, there's ritualized hazing, which is like the 18-year-old picking on the 14-year-old, the 14-year-old picking on the 10-year-old. None of it is too dangerous. What happens with, I'm getting in trouble. What happens with, he's coming in this way. What happens with bullying is actually when you only know people of your age group, all of the hazing rituals and desires turn inward and actually get exponentially worse. And they get exponentially more dangerous. And that's one of the reasons why you see bullying taking place far more in middle, upper class environments and far more in white communities than in Latino and black communities in the United States. So we have to think about what are some of the realistic things. In terms of sex, the most sexual solicitations that are also occurring are also peer-to-peer. And they're the same things of like the boys at school being like, come on, give me a blowjob. Taking place online, and you're like, no. And of course, it's much more visible, which means you can actually do. We have a lot more potential for intervention. And if any of you in the room are social workers or psychologists, this is an amazing opportunity to actually do some unbelievable intervention because we can see what's going on like never before. I can guarantee you that teacher was soliciting sex in other environments before. It's just not effectively. Cops weren't able to effectively get in the way before.
Yeah. Let us thank you.